Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri podcast by me, veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. For some in the human behavioral field, theory of mind represents an exclusively human mental ability. According to this school of thought, only our human brains can claim the capacity to recognize mental states such as knowledge, desire, intentions, belief, or imagination in ourselves. And only human brains possess the capacity to recognize those mental states in others, too. Does it surprise you that ethologists and many who work and live with animals don't accept this? For those who belong in this category, the fact that animals do possess theory of mind is so obvious that we never considered it otherwise. Ironically, though, one place where theory of mind comes into play that we often ignore is when we train dogs using behaviorism. Behaviorism is a teaching method based on the assumption that animals are incapable of cognition, let alone theory of mind. However, it seems to me that dogs, at least, must possess theory of mind to negotiate the minefield of contradictions and inconsistencies inherent in behaviorism with its reward or punishment-based training. Consider the sit command, which, for reasons unknown, often heads the dog training list. From a very young age, puppies normally sit when observing parental figures or those perceived as more fit doing something different or intriguing. The sitting animal is alert and in learning and fact-finding mode that prepares the animal to mimic the other's behavior. This makes sense because the canine brain evolved to learn via this process. Dogs use this position for the same reason and also when surveying their territories for signs of potential threats or novel events. Now consider what happens when people teach puppies or dogs to sit. First, they stand in front of the animal and stare down at him. Then they command the dog to sit. As they do this, some people hold a treat in front of the dog's nose, then move it over the dog's head, which, this training protocol says, will cause the dog to lower his rear end to keep from losing his balance when tracking the treat. In an alternative protocol, the owner yanks the dog's head up with a leash to achieve the same effect. In both cases, if this doesn't cause the dog to drop his rump to the ground, the owner pushes it down while giving the command. Much has been said and written about which protocol is the fastest, most humane, or best for what kind of dog at what age, etc. But all such discussions never doubt the need to teach a dog to sit in the first place, nor do they doubt the person's position as commander-in-chief. Because a significant proportion of the pet dog population does learn to sit on command, how in the world does the average canine manage to make sense of these human teaching strategies? Consider what this process communicates to the dog in canine terms. Direct eye contact means don't move to many dogs. The hissing S sound and the sit command can trigger a deeply entrenched, possibly snake-related defensive canine response. Follow the treat means bend your head back until you start to lose your balance and are forced to put your rear end down. An upward jerk on the leash is another ambiguous as well as uncomfortable physical command for many dogs to obey. Downward pressure in the rump also may trigger defensive response for behavioral or physical reasons. From my perspective, it seems that the only way dogs can make sense of these unrelated and sometimes conflicting human expectations must be because dogs possess theory of mind. The dog must be able to grasp what the person behaving in an otherwise incongruous and incomprehensible manner expects the dog to do, and then offer the desired behavior. Otherwise, how could so many dogs learn to sit? At this point, those who champion theory of mind as a strictly human quality will mention all kinds of reasons why animals could behave in a manner that would cause naive folks such as I to think animals possess such mental capacity when they really don't. What looks like the animal is capable of mental states such as knowledge, desire, intentions, belief, or imagination themselves and to attribute it to others, they say, simply reflects coincidence or dumb luck. Besides that, they go on, canine brains lack the necessary size and structures needed to do this. Of course, these are the same people who believe that animals are incapable of cognition. So it's understandable that they would feel that way. After all, how can one possibly recognize knowledge as a mental state in oneself or others without possessing cognitive abilities? But what does it say about us when we become angry or frustrated when our dogs don't do what we want them to do? And we accuse them of being stupid, spiteful, stubborn, or mean. To me, this suggests that at times we may have a double standard going when it comes to how we teach our animals. On the one hand, we expect our dogs to have theory of mind that enables them to figure out what we want and give it to us, even when we communicate this in a way that makes no sense to them. Moreover, we expect them to make us look good when we and they do this. But on the other hand, when our dogs don't do what we command them, instead of considering what the command and the way we communicated our desire means to the dog, we get angry instead. We know that the dog didn't obey the command, but we neither know nor care why the dog did not. In this scenario, we demonstrate that we possess cognitive abilities, but at times lack sufficient knowledge to include our dogs in our theory of mind. When that's the case, we perceive our response is right simply because we believe we are. Interestingly, in studies of theory of mind development in humans, that's the response of young children. At the end of the day, as the old cliche goes, I suspect a theory of mind, like cognitive abilities in humans and animals, doesn't represent a have or have not situation that differentiates one species from another. Just as humans may demonstrate varying degrees of these capacities, either routinely or intermittently, so may animals. But if we perceive ourselves as responsible for our companion animal's physical, mental, and emotional well-being, then it makes sense to recognize their and our own limitations in the cognitive and theory of mind realm when we interact with them.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore, by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Katova Arts, www.katova.com.